The title of today's talk is Who, What is in Charge of the Doer? Subconscious, cognitive mind, cognitive dissonance, post-traumatic stress, imagination, surrender to the soul. We tend to be in a chronic act. And it starts from a very early age. And we're encouraged to act. Act nice, act feminine, act masculine, act strong, you know, act humble, act, act, act. Let me see, how does that jive with being enlightened? Oh, you're going to act enlightened? You see, there are some things you can only be. You can only be what? That's the question. And it is a question because you don't know that you're acting 99% of the time. When a child starts to become cognitive or aware of the fact that their behavior provokes response, then they begin to see if they can provoke a response they want. I can't tie my shoes. Oh, you know, that sort of thing. It starts very, very, very early. Very before language. Crying gets response. Smiling gets response. Quiet seems not to be too responsive. Noise of one sort or another gets response. So they try out their repertoire of sound making. And this is encouraged by the parents. Giggling, why do we tickle the baby? That is the most absurd thing to do, tickle the baby. But they do. It's almost automatic. The parents will tickle the foot of the baby or tickle the sides to get a smile or a response. So this is response training, pre-verbal. So if you add words with energy, you're further conditioning the child to act, to respond to or create a response. Now, some parents are very indulgent and patient and that sort of thing, and some parents have limited patience and indulgence. So each child, according to the situation of their familial, let's say, each parent has a different relation, each sibling may have a different relationship with patients or learning or interacting with the new child in the house. And all the time, the child is taking cues as to what works when and where. Now, they're very inept at this in the beginning. You know, it's like a little kid wanting to hide from the parent, and they run behind the curtain and they are hiding. Of course, the curtain ends at their knees, and they don't have that kind of sensibility to know that they're showing. And then, depending on the temperament of the parent, they go around saying, oh, where's Johnny? Oh, where's the little girl? Oh, where's our little girl? I don't know, you know, and, oh, let me see, little girl. That phrase is also training. Not only where are they and pretending they're hiding, that the kid is hiding when they are in plain view. You see, it's the ambivalency of their training, each child under different circumstances. It takes them a time to figure out what the act ought to be to get what they want or to get the response they're looking for or think they're looking for. The response may be the exact opposite, and then they have to change the act. Act like a young gentleman. To a 2 or 3 year old? Act like a young lady to a 2 or 3 year old. Now they have to invent young lady or young man. Or act like a man. Be strong. What's be strong? Be polite. What's being polite to a tiny kid? You're not being polite. Aunt Harriet won't like you. What is polite? So they're running through their brain what polite or what kind or what any of the emotional things or descriptive things are. They're making them up. And when they don't do a very good job, the parent gets impatient and says, that's not being polite, or this isn't good, or why are you doing that? You said to do that. So the confusion of growing up is constructing the multi-face act. acting, acting, acting. The child is always in some stage of acting unless they're left alone and they're just in the backyard watching the ants crawl over a rock or something like that. And then their lack of self-consciousness lets them act out, like stomp on the ant or take the wings off a butterfly or take the petals off mother's favorite rose. Because they're exploring their power now. And so they're acting spontaneously to see results. They're not trying to act strong or act polite because, you know, the butterfly really doesn't qualify for Aunt Harriet. You see how this gets squirrely and how you got squirrely. You're carrying around, everyone's carrying around squirrely remnants of growing up. And they play it again, Sam, when you're not cognitive of what's going on subconsciously. It's just playing around in there and dancing through with little scenarios that you're not paying attention to. And then you do some interesting self-talk. And you construct, as you mature, different acts to fit into what you think society needs, wants of you, or what you think you need from society. So you're milking society, and you're also trying to fit in. Society is milking you, and you're milking society. See the problem? This is all stored away, and it all comes up spontaneously whenever it dang pleases, or when situations trigger it. Something reminds you. Most of the time, you're being reminded unconsciously. You don't really think about it. It's just happening. It's just this dialogue going on in the subconscious mind that you're not paying much attention to. And then you have another song and dance which you're paying maybe a little more attention to on the upper scale, which is, I need to do this, I need to do that. I should be doing this, and I could be doing that. And then there's this drag of subconscious stuff that's just distracting you, not letting you settle on doing it. But you're trying hard to be the doer. So, who's in charge of the act? Well, there are certain places in the brain that use chemistry to play it again, Sam, or to become conscious of play it again, Sam. Post-traumatic stress is a very interesting thing. And during wars or occupation of countries or stress in communities, like growing up on the street in gangs and things like that, where there's a lot of stress, or parents that are stressed out because they either are divorced or have problems, or and so they're not what you might say congenial all the time. And so you have a repertoire of things that can create very stressful memories. But when we see veterans coming back from the war, or who have been in very traumatic situations, their post-traumatic stress can become very pronounced. And instead of thinking it's just, oh, how it is, we now know what it is. It's post-traumatic stress. Now, post-traumatic stress has a huge effect on the prefrontal cortex in the ventricle region. The ventricle medial region of the prefrontal cortex is where, when damage is done to the nervous system, it shows up in that region. Now, that means that the prefrontal cortex in the ventricle region, that it spontaneously will act out. And what happens is, as when veterans come home from war and they have nightmares or they have shock reaction, they can do very wild and not so fun things, like slit my aunt's throat. Her husband had post-traumatic stress in World War II. And he slit her throat when she came in to the house. Now, she survived it, which is in... But her roommate had been hacked by her husband, who had post-traumatic stress from the war, with an axe. Now, in their right mind, they would never do that. In their right mind, they loved them. Their right mind. What was their right mind? The mind that wasn't driven by a shock of uncontrollable responsiveness. So, one of the things that's important to understand is in the prefrontal cortex, you also develop a history of appropriate. What is appropriate to this situation or that situation, even though it may be a story. It's a story of appropriateness as you perceive it to make you, let's say, fit in or be, let's say, kind, because you realize that kindness gets things done in a different way. And so the dorsal, the dorsal medial prefrontal cortex, if it is dominating the ventricle, it will subdue responsiveness because it's cognitively aware that's inappropriate. And that's what training with growing up with children and then finally adults in all kinds of situations is trying to achieve a cognitive control over the subconscious reactionalism. The reason I'm going into this is because as you oftentimes think, being, let's say, joyful or relaxed or smiling or sitting still and doing, let's say, what the Buddhists call self-awareness, meditation, you know, and what the masters say in self-reflective analysis. No emotion, just watching detachedly. What is going on in your brain? Now, why that's important is that when you sit quietly, meditatively, watching what's going on in your brain, you're activating the dorsal medial prefrontal cortex, which is the control over the ventricle medial cortex, the reactional one. It's scientific. This isn't just a game. This isn't just something that sounds nice. This is what brings chemical control over reactional subconscious behavior. Duh. And that's what we need to be using in order to get the spontaneous reactional doer under control. So, once again, people can roll their eyes all they want, but the path of the masters is science. It's about the scientific way of getting all the conditioning under control. So when we spend a lot of time in cognitive dissonance, where we're doing what we really know we shouldn't be doing, and rationalizing about it, at some point in time we have to realize that's what we're doing and bring it under control. Or how can you ever attune to the frequency of the soul that uses a softer frequency, a different frequency to express itself in the body brain? We are after being directed by the soul rather than by the mind and the ego and the subconscious and the primitive brainstem, the beast, as it were, the reptilian mammalian brain. And so here we are. We've been conditioned. There's no way a kid grows up not conditioned. There's no way. So, what kind of act are we putting on? all the time we're putting on an act to try to, let's say, muddle through life, get done what we think we want done. But why do we think we need to do it? Why do we have to be the doer on the terms of, let's say, hypnotized, trained, bullied into thinking this is the way it should be, and that we should be? Act like a man. Thank you. Okay? And, you know, it's the old story of, you see all the time pictures of, you know, movies where people are horsing around in their cubicles and talking and doing their thing, and the boss walks by and everybody's acting busy. They don't dare not act busy. And when you go to an interview, oh, what an act you can put on. When you interface with anybody, you can put on an act. Now, basically, it's harmless to greet somebody and be kind. Nice, hello, smile. Smiling helps you. And it may help them. You know, the door greeters at Walmart are usually not 10 years old, and they have a hard time standing for hours as greeters at Walmart. So a smile is well spent. But at the same time, are we being used? Are we using? Or are we actually helping a situation? Is it coming from a heartfelt place, or just a mental place? So is that God greeting you? Or is that poor old lady that looks like she's 75 and she's about ready to keel over? You see, it's very hard for us to differentiate our act from our act from our act. But where, meantime, is the soul? What is the soul doing, and what is the actor canceling? Or usurping, or pretending, or that sort of thing. Now, if you study acting at all, you know that there are several different methods of acting. There's method acting, and there's character acting, and there's free-for-all. And there's stand-up comedians. Oh boy, do they act. They're soliciting a response all the time, aren't they? Stand-up comedians. They want you to respond to them positively by humor. Saturday Night Live is built its whole reputation on that, right? And if you think about it, Johnny Carson was probably the all-time most known actor because he was on every night. And he had amazing influence on his audiences, much more than people gave him credit for, because he was continuously there and he was continually bringing people and situations to your attention that he chose. Interesting. Well, the whole path of the masters is about how to get hold of the act, the actor in us, and bring it down to manageable size, so that it's not running away with the real doer, keeping you in the realm of the doer as opposed to the soul and God power as the doer. How is my act going? How is my response getting? What am I getting fed back? Rather than how quiet out of the way can I be? The Tao. I alone do not know what I am doing. The Tao is itself. And if I am quiet internally, the Tao acts without resistance where I am. The Tao will work anyway, but I will be doing a different jig. I will have a different perception because I'm in my mind. I'm in my belief systems. I'm in my storytelling. I'm in my collection of motives and other people's motives and my response to their motives. Oh, isn't that cute? Yes. Well, you know, you can play all kinds of games. And in the end, enlightenment is about getting rid of the games and settling to know that divine is in charge. God power is in charge. Not you, dearie. God power is in charge, and what will be, but you may get kicked in the behind because you're being trained to let divine be divine. The doer, the only doer. So when you lose your pawns while you're playing chess, remember that God power is always checkmate. You're not going to outsmart God ever. Ever. And God's at play always. God's written the rules. God designed the board. You have no way of winning. You have only surrender. It's the only thing open is surrender and inner quietude to the doer. So, we've waltzed around this idea of the only doer for a very long time. And I try to constantly come at it from a different angle so that it shows you how diverse and how clever you have been conditioned by being in the biological body. The moment you got locked into the biological body, the training started. You got into the self-preservation experience, the pain and the fight and the flight come with birth into the body. So you're in a setup. How does divine train us? Well, sets up the chessboard and all the pieces are put into play, and each play is monitored and designed by God, God power, soul. And the way to accommodate to the truth is to stop acting. You have to stop acting brave, strong. You know, I gotta do this, I have to do this. Nobody will like me if I do that, da 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 da. Think of all the nonsense that goes on in growing up, trying to fit in. Junior high is the worst. Junior high and high school. Puberty, oh my God. I think they should have a separate island for puberty. And when they're done, they might come back and you might start again. But teenage years are very difficult because the hormones are changing and that sort of thing. And what was the conditioning going on before gets quantum leaps of change when the hormones start getting strong. And during puberty, you don't know who you are, but you're real sure you think you know who you are, and you're going to tell your parents that you know more than they know, and they're just old-fashioned, and da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and what's the matter with them? But the problem is, all those reactional behaviors from the time little tiny children begin to hear the word no, and they get resentful, that's still locked in the nervous system. And when you're in puberty and you are trying to look cute and start wearing makeup and get a new bra and that sort of thing, and the boys are going to gym to look tough, big, that sort of thing, they're collecting more major reactions that get locked into the nervous system unknowingly. So it's monitoring and managing and modifying parts and pieces of behavior in different situations. And that's a lot of undoing that has to be undone. And so it's not like, oh, I can spend an hour here and an hour there, or, you know, whatever. And I can think of being cheerful and joyful and da-da-da-da, and that's all great and well. But does it really produce the release of that stored data? You have to understand that transmutation is the release of stored data. And you can't transmute in 10 minutes here and a smile there and a there. It has to be what you do full time. Controlling, why would the, you know, it's so peculiar that you can hear, hurry and worry kill the man. That must be saying, don't hurry and don't worry. And the Buddhists make that a priority in their behavior training. But Christians, hurry up and get to church and, you know, look smart when you're sitting in the bench and pass the sacrament and look, you know, you're 12 years old and you've got pimples and everything and you're passing the, you know, the ceremony of, you know, whatever you're going to do, like you're a grown-up missionary or you're a grown-up elder. You're an elder at 12? Give me a break. Yeah. You see, this is game playing. This is hypnosis. This is trying to make you something that is artificial. And that's basically what we are. Artificial. Art. Artificial. To be or not to be, that is the question. We had camp to be, did we not? Probably have had it about 4 or 5 times and it doesn't seem to stick. Okay. So we have to keep coming at it from different angles because you learned under different situations. And so different things trigger for you and others don't. So if you see this as the greatest challenge and the greatest joy, to know that the tools work, but you have to understand what you're trying to achieve by using the tools, because it's deconstruction of historical stored reactionalism. It's deconstruction of reactionalism. And so the prefrontal cortex getting attention is important. And the prefrontal cortex is where you put your attention when you're meditating. It is helping to develop the ability for transmutation and control over spontaneous reactionalism from the history of all of your conditioning. So, it's all science. You're trying to assist the body clearing of stored reactionalism. In other words, every reaction you have to a stimuli that seems spontaneous is basically, you could call it post-traumatic stress reactionalism. It's stored away reactionalism. Two, belief systems. What is post-traumatic stress? It's damage to the ventricle, medial, prefrontal cortex system. And that, in fact, triggers the amygdala, which is the primitive chemistry set of reactionalism and self-defense. You see, it's scientific. And we're trying to undo eons of time of how this system evolved. So, yes, it's work. On Sunday morning program, there were two interesting people. One was a Dr. Zully Coffett, and he was a black pediatrician, 65 or 66. And he had been a pediatrician in Baltimore, Maryland, in the black area of town. And he had made it his life's agenda to provide top-notch pediatric help to people that were in need. Some could pay, some were poverty-ridden, and he would never expect payment from them. Now, he did this for years and years. He built a fantastic reputation among his patients. They loved him. Well, suddenly, a year or two ago, he was diagnosed with two forms of cancer. Strangely enough, this intelligent, wonderful pediatrician had not taken or kept up to date his insurance. And all of the treatments that he got, he couldn't afford to pay for. So the community gathered their funds together and paid them all. Now, this is an interesting statement that he made. It's the best thing that ever happened to me. It's the best thing that ever happened to me because I realized the profound love and respect that people actually had for me. I had no idea. Well, he has since gotten a better insurance program going. And he is in, I think he said, what they think is remission. So he's busy at work still. Now that was one interesting portion on the program. The other one was an interview with the very famous Olympiad skier, Lindsey Vonn, who now resides in Park City. She's 40 years old and planning on returning after 8 years of retirement from solemn Olympic skiing. She did some major damage to her legs. And what she found over time was that every joint in her body ached from all of the damage. Well, she also said that she was driven and driven and driven when she was practicing for the Olympics, that everything was about her winning the Olympics. Everything. What she ate, when she slept, where she went, what competitions she entered, who she associated with, who her coaches were, what her ski equipment was, what her clothing was, everything was about her being a skier. When she retired, she began to realize life had some other aspects to it, including pain. And so finally, I think it was 2 or 3 years ago, she had new knees put in. And it took her months of diligent training and exercise to get to a place where she could actually ski again. And what she found out was that she was free of pain. And what she found out was she was a better skier than she had been. And what she found out was, that's nice. Maybe I'll try for the Olympics, but it's not the only thing in my life. She discovered herself free of the plan, the idea of being an Olympiad skier. And so now it's fun. And she lives a life and she skis. Interesting. Both of these people, in different ways, had to discover something different about themselves. So, here we are. Can you actually do the path and live? I mean, happily live. Yes, but you have to discover it by doing it. Well, who, what is in charge of the doer? Only one doer. And if we can learn to release our idea of doership, releasing, 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 but that means erasing and erasing traumas that are stored in the deep subconscious that want to act out. And they have no business in your now life. But they show their ugly head to test you. And that's why it's so hard to enlighten, is because they're rooted very deep in the nervous system, in the history. And so remaking the nervous system and remaking the ideas of doership are integral parts of enlightenment. It's scientific. So when you change the chemistry of the brain, you also begin to change the chemistry of the construction of cells so that they get closer and closer to the archetype potential of transcendence. It's science. It's science. It's letting go of all of that emotional claptrap that's stored and wants to act out all the time. So, you know, it's a sport. It's a sport. And it's fun if you let it be. If you stop traumatizing yourself over it. But trauma is so, so experiential. Well, so is joy. Joy is experiential if you will allow it. If you allow the joy. Over and over and over again, choosing joy as opposed to post-traumatic stress memories that want to play it again, Sam. I want to do it myself. Well, you're never going to do it yourself, kiddo. Yeah. You're never going to do it yourself. But you have to use the cognitive part of your brain to tell the subconscious reactional part of your brain, sit down, smile, and shut up. Life is about joy, not about trauma.